This is the Author Archive podcast. I'm David Freeman. The book today is new, and it's a subject that I didn't think I was interested in at all, but it's a fabulous book. It's called My Fishing Life by Ashley Mullinger. Congratulations on your book. Did you know you were a writer?
I'm still not sure I am. Thank you, by the way. No, I'm still not sure that I am a writer. I've always enjoyed writing. Even when I was at school, I enjoyed writing. Whether I was any good at it, though, was a different thing.
Well, you definitely are. You call this book My Fishing Life. So this life, I mean, just let's start. What do you do?
I am a commercial fisherman, and we are targeting crabs, lobsters and whelks in pots. So unlike a trawler that would tow a net and catch fish, we use pots to target what we catch. And we do a little bit of hook and line as well for species like mackerel, cod, maybe a little bit of squid here and there. So that's the predominant thing that we do.
And what sort of vessel do you do this in?
So at the moment, I'm primarily using Saoirse, or Saoirse as you should pronounce it. And she is an 8-meter fiberglass boat, and she's like a little bath toy, but I love her dearly.
I mean, in this book, which is an engrossing read, at one point you say, oh, we go out even in storms that have got names. I mean, I wouldn't like to go out in a storm that's got a name, in something that small and feeling that vulnerable.
And sometimes that's the appeal of it. And sometimes when you get back from a day like that, you feel absolutely exhausted. Every muscle in your body is singing, and you know that you've put in a really good hard day's graft. But then sometimes the motivator to go out is because you have bills to pay. And if that boat's not out there working, then you're not going to earn anything.
Okay. I mean, this book starts, you're not being a fisher person. Well, right early on, you're going off at 2 o'clock in the morning to a boat. But what I couldn't really understand is you had a proper job. You were paid. You went in at 9 and you left at 5 and you got paid. And you didn't put your life at risk. You weren't in danger of drowning, and you didn't have to do it all hoping to get the odd whelk. I mean, so what did you do, and what was wrong with it?
What did I do and what was wrong with it? So I worked basically in like a responsive logistics management kind of a role. Teams of engineers having to go out and fix things that were either like a for a while I did it for heating and hot water, so you know, these were time critical things that I needed to get an engineer to fix, and I looked after a team of people that managed their workload. And then I did a similar role for instant boiling and cold water taps, and it was all very like, because it was responsive, it was all very high stress, high pressure. And a lot of them were social housing contracts as well. So we had, sort of KPIs, and we had targets that we had to hit. And the day was just relentless, especially in the winter months when the phone wouldn't stop. People were asking you questions all the time. And even though I could do the job, it was just the same monotony every single day. It was get up, go to work, put your work face on, and go and solve somebody else's problems. And I think it just got to the point where it was like, I am living my life purely for 5 o'clock on a Friday. And then when Sunday evening rolls around at 6 o'clock, you get that fear and that doom of, oh no, I've got to start the work week again. And I'd had enough, I think, of that and that just existence. I was like, where does this end? I could see no end to it.
Then you and two mates decide to do something completely different.
Yeah.
And now, what was the thinking behind it, and what did you do?
So, I mean, we had a great social circle of friends where I worked. They were fantastic people. And we often would socialise at the weekend. And I said, what do you want to do this weekend, or like in a couple of weekends' time? Shall we all go out and do something different? And they were like, yeah, what, any ideas? And I'm like, okay, so it's on me then to find out what we're going to do. So I was like, well, what about fishing? Because I grew up in a village where there was lots of duck ponds, and every weekend as a young teenager, we would go out like just fishing for like roach and carp. So fishing was something that I'd done a lot as a child. I was like, well, but what about sea fishing? So I literally just typed into Google Norfolk sea fishing. It's the most logical thing to type into Google, I suppose. And up popped a company that were offering charter angling trips from Wells next to the sea, which is 20 minutes from where I live. And yeah, booked on. And that first trip was this complete light bulb moment.
The other two weren't affected in the same way.
Oh, they enjoyed it, but they didn't get that lightning bolt hit like I did.
But the skipper looked at your footwear to start with. I mean, presumably you were all right, but one of them was wearing flip-flops, which didn't go down well.
No, and to this day, anyone with flip-flops trying to get onto a boat, he has like a shudder.
Now, can you explain to me, in your book, you write about it very poetically, but here we are, we're talking at 4 minutes past 10 of a Tuesday morning. Can you explain to me, in the cold light of a grey April morning, what it was that lit your soul, that put you on fire?
And I think we have to then just circle back to what I was used to on an everyday basis, and that constant demand for me to be solving people's problems, having the phone ring, emails coming at you at 300 miles an hour, clogging up your inbox. And then you go out there and there's none of that. And nobody can reach you on your phone. And it's just you, it's the boat, it's the skipper, and it's the environment. And it's empty and it's lonely, and it just relies on your instinct and your ability alone. And I think that is just so cleansing for your entire being. And I think it was that opposite of just, no one can reach me here. This is a magical place that I've never seen before, and I'm fascinated by it.
Could buy that for one day. But then, sometimes the wind blows, sometimes it rains. You say you don't get seasick, but probably other people do. So you decide to make yourself vulnerable, cold, and lonely every bloody day.
You put it like that. But this is the thing, it's not cold every single day in the summer, and I don't. And this is the thing, I find it so hard to sum up the way that it makes me feel being out there, because you're relying on yourself and you're relying on your own strength and you're relying on your own instincts. And the sea challenges you in a way that nothing else really can, because the sea can do exactly what it wants. Don't get me wrong, we have an idea as to what we're going to be facing based on, weather forecasts and the information that we know and that we learn. But ultimately, it's a challenge like no other, and I love that challenge. And I learn something every day. You learn new things and you experience new things. And working in a physical environment rather than just relying on your brain alone to solve problems and answer questions, you're relying not only on your mind, but the strength of your every single muscle in your body just to keep yourself upright, let alone do a job, is so refreshing. You don't feel like you're just existing in your mind, in your own mind. You're existing in all of you.
When you were working in an office, you had a nice loo.
Yes.
If you wanted to put on makeup, that was all right. I'm only guessing in this little boat, you don't have that.
No, what do I have in the boat that's any kind of luxury? I have a gas stove that I can boil water on to have a pot noodle at the end of the day, and that's about where my luxury stops.
I mean, you write about them. And one of the heroes that comes out in your book is a bloke that you call Nige. Now, when you went to do this, were there sort of rolled eyes and raised eyebrows? What the hell does she think she's doing? Was it like that?
It was, but I think people, and certainly the people in the town and the community, got to understand that I really loved what I did and that I loved being at sea. So when, because I was a familiar face on the angling boat that Nige had. So when eventually he took the leap and went to commercial, and then I came back and worked for him, I don't think it was too strange a situation. Certainly my friends and family were like, okay, like they were all very supportive, don't get me wrong. But a lot of my colleagues in the office, they were like, really, you're actually going to do that? And I'm like, yes, I am, because I need to change. I need to know if it's something I can do.
I mean, here you are. You're talking to me. You're in the prime of life. Can you see? I mean, look me in the eye. Can you be doing this in 30 years?
I hope so.
Really?
I hope so. And it might be that the way that we fish has changed by then. The technologies and things are changing all the time. My bigger concern is, can I, is not if I can do it in 30 years, is this industry going to be here in 30 years? That's my bigger concern. And what is the industry going to look like in 30 years? Because our marine environment is changing dramatically. Wind farms and our need for greener, cleaner energy being one of the biggest catalysts for that.
Towards the end of the book, you get on your hobby horse and you have a little preach, and I was cheering you on.
Oh God, I'm so glad to hear that feedback. And it wasn't just me ranting. I'm glad that you've said that.
Need people to rant. Now, let me just ask, when you haul in whatever you're hauling in, what do you do with it? Where does it go? How do you sell it?
So the whelks will all go to Korea via King's Lynn for processing. They love them. I think they tin them, and they are probably the equivalent we would have is something like fish and chips. So for them, if they went on a, I took actually took a Korean reporter out to see once to show her how we caught them, and she was fascinated, and she was like, yeah, we would eat them if we'd had a night out in Korea. That would be what we'd have after we'd had, a few drinks or as a bar snack, something like that. So that's where all the whelks are going. The crab and the lobster that we catch all stays locally, I'm happy to report. But that's not the case for the industry entirely. We have big Asian exports for crab. The cod and the mackerel that we catch hook and line, I actually sell locally now on the quayside and to small restaurants, pubs and things locally. But that's only because we don't have the infrastructure in the smaller harbours like where I'm from to be able to access markets, because the infrastructure is not there anymore. A lot of, and up and down the country, you'll find the same. The fish markets and the logistics just don't exist.
Are you saying they used to exist, but they don't anymore?
I'm saying that they used to be a lot better, and we were probably a lot more diverse in what we were catching on all boats. But because of all the different management mechanisms that have been put in place, a lot of our fleets have almost been divided and segregated. So you'll find, sort of certainly where I am, yes, we have a really good shellfish, or shellfish coastline, but those boats now can't really access any other species because of the way that quota has been divvied up, which, I go into in the book. So they don't bother, and therefore the infrastructure that supports those types of fisheries dwindles.
The fact that we are semi-detached from Europe, does that have any knock-on for you?
Semi-detached is probably the right word. Does it at the moment? Not overly. However, I think, and I go into it in great detail in the book, I'm worried about how the industry is going to change as a result, and access to quota, and us starting to try and bring quota back into this country. But with all the other small, and I say small in inverted commas, when you start adding up all of the different restrictions that are coming in to the specifically the small boats, all that quota that's coming back, is it just going to end up again in those in the hands of those that are rich and powerful? And eventually we will see the constructive loss of the under 10-meter fleet. That's my woe is me. Completely doomed outlook on it. And I think it's hard to summarize that without having that context unless you've read the
Read the book, and I love it. I
book.
just want to hear you say it. That's
Oh.
why, because you're a fabulous advocate for this industry that you now find yourself in. You can talk to me and the people that download this podcast, but do genuine, bright, concerned politicians ever listen to you? Because, I mean, genuine, bright politicians, I sometimes think, oh, goodness me. They said a lot before the EU referendum about how it was all going to be wonderful. I didn't believe them, and I was right not to believe them. But do these people ever come and talk to you?
I think some of them are trying, but I think there are a lot of barriers between fishermen and policymakers. And I think that's because of the decades of knee-jerk reactions to fisheries management. There is no trust there anymore. I do think they are trying, but I also don't think that they understand where the industry has been. I don't think they understand the 50, 60 years of management and what they did, what happened as a result, and then what they then did to counter that, and then what happened as a result. So they don't fully understand that entire history. So they then can't seem to have constructive conversations with fishermen as a result of that.
So the things that make you rant at the back end of my fishing life, are these day-to-day things, or do you and your colleagues sometimes really stand back and see it from a distance, how it really is?
Oh, good question. I think the when you say day-to-day things, I mean, you only have to pick up a copy of the Fishing News, which publishes weekly, and I'll sit on the quay and talk to a couple of the other fishermen. It's like, have you seen this now? Have you seen that now? Oh, they're doing this now. Oh, they're bringing this change in now. And then you do start to add everything up, and you're like, and then you've got this, and then you've got X and Y and Z, and combine that with, X, A, and then you're like, hang on a minute. The job's hard enough without having to worry about all these other legislative changes that feel like all they're trying to do is pick off all the small boats that are already struggling.
Yeah. So, climate change. I get very exercised by climate change. What do you see day by day in your work about climate change?
Climate change is certainly at the forefront of our minds when we're doing the job that we do. And that's mainly because we can't now go out to sea and look at a nice big expanse of open sea, but wind farms. And the southern North Sea, which is where we are, is pretty much the offshore wind farm capital of the world. And I'm not ignorant to the fact that we need cleaner energy. And we can, we're consuming energy at an alarming rate as a nation, as a global population. I'm not ignorant to that. But that said, the spatial conflicts that come as a result of these wind farms. So every time a wind farm is put up, they will need you out of the site. Those boats with their pots have to go somewhere. And that may mean that they are now fishing on top of you or where you were fishing. Or you might then have to move your pots and go and put them next to somebody else. And that makes a piece of ground that was sustainable for one boat to be working, now less sustainable as a result. And the other taboo subject, which not many people talk about, is the fact that fishermen are compensated to stay out of the areas when they're constructing these wind farm sites. And also, they, you know, these things don't just pop up overnight. It's survey after survey after survey. So you need to keep out, you need to keep all your gear out because we're surveying the ground. We need to know what's down there, what could be in our way. And, you know, it takes years. And that it can make people very rich very, very quickly. And the issue you have with that is that people will then inorganically grow their business. So the boats that they did have and the pots that they did have then get upscaled really, really quick. So the boats become more efficient. They become able to push more weather. They put more gear on the ground. And as a result of that, every time a new site comes up, oh, I've got gear in the way. Well, of course you have. The wind farm company probably paid for it 2 years previous. And my concern is, how long can our sea sustain that level of, you know, increases in gear, increases in our productivity before it becomes too late? And I wish that the wind farm companies could do some science to try and understand if they are doing damage to our marine stocks as a result of their decisions to pay fishermen a lot of money to keep out of these areas. Does that make sense?
It does. I didn't know it happened. I mean, this is a revelation to me. It seems to me, talking to you, you need to get some television company to make a documentary with you, because I didn't know.
No, and it's taboo because of course, you know, being offered money to keep out of a site is, in respects, the right thing to do, because that is going to impact our businesses. However, what we then do, some then do with that money, is that having a detrimental effect on fish stocks? Big question mark. And I wish there was some kind of evidence to back that claim, in inverted commas, up. But it concerns me, it does.
Are you a lone voice? Or if you were sitting on the key wells next to sea now, would other people be going, yeah, you're quite right, Ash, you're quite right?
I think, and this is where, you know, you get a little bit, it gets contentious, because there'll be those that have made a lot of money and they'll say, no, that's not true. And you'll be like, yeah, because you've made a lot of money out of that. Whereas others who are perhaps can see it for what it is would probably say, yeah, you're probably right, but nobody wants to talk about it because everybody's done quite well out of it. So, and you know, I'll put my hand on my heart. I've had compensation paid for keeping out of an area. I'd love to be in a position to say, hey, do you know what? No, I don't want your money, Mr. Wind Farm. But unfortunately, who can say, no, sorry, I don't want your money?
Well, you've taught me something that I didn't know. I love the poetic writing in your book. It's called My Fishing Life, A Story of the Sea. Ashley Mullinger, congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I must just say as well that I've had help with this book from an amazing ghostwriter called Lynn Barrett Lee. And she is just fabulous. And having that help from somebody who had, you know, no idea about our industry, she was so inquisitive. And she's like, I want to know more about that, or you need to talk to me more about this, or we need to expand upon that. So having that layperson's view while we were creating it, fantastic. And I can't thank her enough. And she's become a lifelong friend now as well.
You did the living. You did it. It was your idea. So well done for that. Thanks, Ash.
Thank you.